Welcome to Talking Energy, the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hello, welcome to Talking Energy. I'm UK Energy Research Director Rob Gross. I'm joined today by Richard Lowes, who's a senior associate at the Regulatory Assistance Project, and by Dara Vyas, who is Deputy Director for Policy at the industry trade body, Energy UK. The topic of the podcast today is taking stock of heat and buildings policy in the UK. There was a major new heat and buildings strategy launched towards the end of last year. That's 2021. But of course, events have really got quite dramatically different, even since that policy was published, with the rapid increase in gas prices, continued concerns about conflict in Ukraine, a recent decision at the time we're recording this for the German government to actually turn down the kind of gas pipeline from Russia, all of which sets a pretty challenging context of rising bills that overlay the pre-existing aspirations to move towards net zero and to decarbonize our heating systems. I'm going to throw a question at Richard first. So does the gas price crisis change what we think we want to do around, you know, changing our heating systems, the way that we heat our homes, change our priorities?
Well, I think fundamentally it does change everything. The big question is, how long will these gas price rises last for? Are they something that will stay for the foreseeable, or will we return back to what we think of relatively normal gas prices in a year or two? And then we've been thinking that, and then all of a sudden we're talking about war in Ukraine and the first major new pipeline to Europe from Russia, Nord Stream 2, effectively being cancelled. So while we may have thought the gas prices would go back down in the shorter term, that seems unlikely now. Maybe for 2 or 3, maybe even 4 years. And anyone that says they'll predict energy prices on a longer than 2 year basis is probably a bit foolish. But all of the signs are pointing towards something a bit longer term than I think we were first expecting. And so what that means is that everything that was cost effective before, be that energy efficiency or solar PV or offshore wind even, is much more cost effective all of a sudden. And in many ways, that really flips the economics of heat decarbonisation to something that looks way more positive than it did once. And taking that even further, if you look at all of the positive things alongside this big negative, so the cost falls in offshore wind, the cost falls in solar, the effective increase in the payback with things like energy efficiency, if you add those things together, over the longer term, I think it now actually looks cheaper to heat a house with a heat pump combined with solar PV than it does with gas. And that really is transformative.
Okay, Richard, there's quite a lot there that we could come back to. So, Dara, what's the industry view of what's required? I mean, obviously, we're focused here on we're not really talking about responding to the gas price crisis. We can, but focusing that in on heat.
No, it's a very good question, and it's quite nice to think specifically about heat in this place, because actually, there are no silver bullets when it comes to decarbonising the way that we heat homes. There are a range of technologies, heat pump, hybrid heat pumps, direct electric heat, heat networks, hydrogen to what percent, etc. Are we exploring other low carbon gas, heat from waste? You know, there's lots of different options. I think with hydrogen, there are uncertainties around its eventual role, what role it could have with INC or transport, and lots of different trials going on for domestic heat as well. But what we do know for a fact is that there is a limited role for hydrogen until the early or mid 2030s. The emission targets are really challenging for homes, 2030, 2035 emissions targets. And electrification plays just a really key role when it comes to decarbonising heat, whichever pathway you take. And when we talk about pathways, we're talking about the different approaches you could take, and they're set out using different bits of advice and evidence and things like the Climate Change Commission put together the different kind of pathways as well. And I think we need a twin track approach. We need to aggressively move forward on heat decarbonisation. There are, as Richard said, you know, there's a lot of no and low regrets options, and they're proving to be more and more affordable given the gas price crisis, given the the context of the gas price crisis. We're talking about macroeconomic issues which are affecting the cost of living, which hit those who can least afford it the hardest. We're talking about geopolitical issues which are outside of our control and likely outside of our government's control. These are all impacting on what people pay to have a warm, safe, comfortable home. And anything we can do to make that link between more domestic homegrown renewables and affordable heating for our homes, we ought to be doing.
Great. Interested in what you said about hydrogen just now. I don't want to make this all about hydrogen versus heat pumps, because I think the debate has moved on. But if we're thinking about the role that hydrogen will play some role in the energy system, quite what that role might be, I think that would be another conversation for another podcast, another day. But I mean, presumably, high gas prices mean that one of the routes to hydrogen, so-called blue hydrogen, where we take natural gas, combine that with carbon capture and storage, and then take the hydrogen, you know, with the carbon removed, and use it for long distance transport or industry or heat or whatever it might be. I mean, presumably the economics of that look less good the higher the more. As Richard's right, we can't predict the gas price in 3 years or certainly 30 years, but the economics of that must change the way we think about blue hydrogen.
I suspect they do. I think the thing with hydrogen is that there still remain a huge number of unanswered questions on how it would work in the home. But also, we still actually have a lot of questions around unabated gas, don't we? I think it's widely accepted that gas is actually going to be a transitionary fuel. We are going to need it into the 2030s. However, Energy UK members have committed to, you know, be seeking an energy system that doesn't have any more unabated gas in the 2030s. And our members span a range of generators and energy suppliers, but they also include a number of companies that are doing really interesting, diverse things in that space around new energy services and heat. And I think when you look at the system as a whole, there's so much potential and so much optimism around what we could achieve that I completely agree with you. The conversations around hydrogen versus electrification of heat, we need to move on from it, because I think it's the CCC approach on the lowest cost pathways around hydrogen picking up, what, 10 or 11% of heat demand, something like that. And that's, we're going to need multiple solutions. This is a huge, complex problem. And what we don't have is time.
I completely agree. CCC, by the way, is Committee on Climate Change Committee. They've changed their name. But at UKIP, we're very concerned about the transition and how we actually manage gas through this through this period. But perhaps, again, with something we could pick up another time. The heat and building strategy. Let's come back to that. It's published last year, and it was published to kind of widespread mild disappointment. Is that be a fair characterization? Slightly an underwhelming response. Many see it as a letdown. What should the government be prioritizing in this space? Richard, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I fundamentally think it was amazing that they actually got it out last year, to be honest, because there was a huge amount of political wrangling around it with, you know, some Tory MPs and ministers not wanting any sort of intervention in the energy market. So that it was released is a really good thing and a positive sign. And I think some of the noises around particularly heat pumps in it were very positive. So support for new heat pump policies, a new market-based mechanism to come in 2024 to drive the country towards the sort of mass heat pump deployment that we need to reach the net zero goals. But when I read it, there were two huge holes, and I've spoken to Bayes about these holes. A big one is energy efficiency. So despite all of the Insulate Britain protests last year and all the noise made, there's a huge energy efficiency shaped hole in the heat and building strategy. And there's no clear sign that funding will increase for that, even though we need a huge amount more funding for energy efficiency. And if we don't do the energy efficiency, we're really missing the basics of this transition, because energy efficiency is almost the glue that holds everything together, because it makes everything easier. It makes low carbon heating cheaper to run. And it means that your energy system can be smaller, so you can do it more quickly. The other big hole was that there was very little about local politics and local governance and what local authorities should be doing around heat. And while the heat pump side's really, really important, at the other side in urban areas, we also know that heat networks will be a really, really important technology. And while it did say, the strategy said heat networks are important and we expect a big role for them, it gave very little away about how they were actually going to be delivered, when we know fundamentally that they've got to be delivered locally, and a really key player will be local authorities. And so I think overall it was good it got out, but I guess a bit more work is needed on those two fronts in particular.
Okay. Yes, I think that the energy efficiency side of things has been given more attention as a result of the gas prices, but it's obviously a multifaceted problem. We're going to need to ramp up the skills and the supply chain. All of these things are going to take time. And that hasn't been helped by the kind of stop-start approach and some of the false starts in heat decarbonisation. So what's the industry view, Dara, of what's needed to kickstart the transition and you know, pay a bit more attention to our drafty old homes?
So I think Rich's reflections on the heat and building strategy are absolutely spot on. And I appreciate you've asked me for the industry point of view there, Rob, but I'm going to put a consumer point of view forward as well, if that's okay.
Of course, yeah, please do.
In that, I think there was a lot of good stuff in the heat and building strategy, and it's really important not to underplay the complexity and political wrangling that was going on during the years that preceded and resulted in the heat and building strategy. I think that there were some potentially wasted opportunities around things like new build and future home standard and things like that. But most importantly, I think that there's this huge behaviour change aspect that we perhaps don't talk about enough when it comes to heat in our homes. I think that considering the customer is going to be vital, because we're in a world where consumer offers are massive, aren't they? Businesses around the world invest sums of money making things as easy as possible for people to access products and services. There's a great example that Laura Sands uses around the kind of Tesco club card analogy, where Tesco claims to be able to predict consumer behaviours within sort of 80 to 85% accuracy based on what you know about what they're using. You know, it would be great if we could move energy to being an area where actually we're able to use the data and information about people with their consent to make it more responsive to people's needs, right? And I think there's something around that. And that's kind of in the future. But for now, I think, you know, actually retrofitting a house is really hard, and people can't work out how to make the changes that are right for them. They just can't. It's really hard. And it's not just cost. It's also things like horror stories of things going wrong. And I just think there's something there around that consumer protections, information support, advice piece that was missing in the heat and building strategy, which I found disappointing, because I think it's really important. But from the kind of industry point of view, I think that actually, retail market reform is really linked with a lot of this, because we have a retail market model which is focused on switching as the way that you interact with the customer. And actually, in order to deliver a transformation and decarbonize heat in homes, we need reform so that retail energy suppliers are supported to develop long-term relationships with customers based on value, not on short-term switches. We need retail market companies to be taking risks, developing new products, services, you know, and not be thinking, well, that customer's going to move on in 6 months. It's about actually how you stimulate other parts of the business and how you attract investment into energy suppliers, because they do know their customers. And it is this piece of the net zero jigsaw where it's not all about, you know, decarbonizing generation. We've done really well in this country, and we should continue to invest in homegrown domestic renewables, but we also have to change behaviours. We also have to do things with people in their homes, and the energy supply market and those companies in the retail space are really well placed to do it. Some great examples of how it's happening, but we need more, and we need to attract investment. And that means fundamentally rethinking the retail market. And that includes things like energy bills and the policy levies that are on energy bills. We do need to make sure it's, you know, cheaper to switch to low carbon heat. We also need to make sure that we're thinking about whether it's we're paying for things in the fairest possible way, whether we're paying for things like energy efficiency programs in the fairest possible way. Should policy costs in this space be moved into taxation, which is less regressive than having it on energy bills? I think there's a few different changes that could happen in the retail market space that would make it a lot easier to decarbonize heat. We don't talk about it as a heat issue, but it is a heat issue.
Yeah, and I think there are some really exciting innovations happening in supply, and I think Dara's right. There's room for even further innovation that retail market review, pricing, and I can't remember what the consultation is called around equity and pricing, I think that's supposed to be due out now. But as well as that, there's a really fundamental thing happening that needs to happen here rather than is happening, which is that currently we basically all of the capital that we spend on heating is up at the top of the market. So we spend money on gas extraction and gas pipes. And what the heat transition looks like, if you think an idealized zero carbon house is one that's more efficient than a house now with a heat pump with solar panels on the top, is that all of that capital that you're investing in heat actually moves from the top of the energy supply chain to the householder. Because you need to invest in your PV, that might be £3,000 or £4,000. Your heat pump might be the same again. Your insulation might be the same again. So we're talking maybe £15,000-£20,000 of capital per house. And currently, no one's offering that in the market. Interestingly, if you go to Scotland, the model does exist. And in response to the point about consumers too, there's a helpline you can phone up. That helpline will point you towards grants, towards loans, towards a whole package of measures. And actually in Scotland, if you want to do it, you can make it happen. So none of this is rocket science, or none of this is brain surgery. It's just about joining some things up. And there's a really basic thing we haven't got here, which is a loan system that allows people to do this. And even the Committee on Climate Change, in their response to, I think, to the heat and building strategy, pointed towards the German example of the KfW Bank, which basically offers free loans to households. Something that simple could really transform the sector now, particularly because stuff's got much more cost effective. And it's like we have to do these really basic things as well as some of the more complex stuff around retail market arrangements.
Let's unpack that a bit, though, shall we? Because if you go back in time, quite a long time ago now, because a lot of these policies were taken away, there used to be a number of different obligations on energy providers, retailers or suppliers, as they're called, to make investments in energy efficiency on behalf of their customers. They were basically told to, and as a result, they offered free insulation, or to change your light bulbs back in the day when we all had very inefficient light bulbs, and that was driving energy efficiency improvement. And that energy efficiency improvement largely ground to a halt when those programs were stopped. On the other hand, some of the stuff they were doing was what you might call the low-hanging fruit. So it was the relatively easy stuff. And some of the things that, Richard, you just mentioned that sound expensive, that's because they're the more difficult things to get for people to do with their houses. And I completely understand Dara's point that if you want to get an energy company to help finance this or to provide the expertise to do this, they're not very likely to do that if the main thing that the government wants to encourage people to do is to keep swapping their suppliers around at the drop of the hat. And I think one of the things that the energy gas price crisis has shown us is that swapping suppliers around can't actually fix a fundamental problem, that the supply of gas is constrained and it's a global market, all of those things. But I'm just challenging this a bit, Richard, because we have tried providing people loans before, haven't we? We've had two schemes that failed in this country to give people loans. So is that really the answer, or do we need to do other things as well?
Well, I think one of the schemes failed before it even started. And there were policy issues with what was called the Green Deal at the time from the beginning, because it was given a very high commercial interest rate, I think of 7.5%. Which was just silly. The KfW loans in Germany are around, I think, 1%. So effectively, it's free money. You don't really pay any interest. So that scheme was just designed badly. And people, including myself, said it was designed badly at the time. And the government pushed it through because of politics, of course. But I don't actually think that finance on its own is the solution to this. I just think it's a very important part of the puzzle. Because if you allow access to very cheap finance, and if you give people grants support if needed, what that then means is that then you can make slightly more, I guess, controversial or intrusive interventions in the energy market, like, for example, a carbon tax or like a gas boiler ban, which is being considered in the 2030s. Because once you've got those backstop measures in that can support people to make the changes, then suddenly making a bigger change is less of an issue because that household can then use, for example, a free loan or can use the grant scheme that's in place. So I think finance is very, very important, but it's not going to do it on its own.
Okay, thanks. What are your thoughts on that, Dara?
I agree. It has to be a combination of different vectors. And go back to the kind of customer journey stuff. I think there have been a number of, you know, missed opportunities, I'd say, in this space. And I think the lessons from it include, you know, we need to design schemes that people can understand and engage with. As Richard said, it's not rocket science, but we seem to keep getting it wrong. We need to take all the opportunities available to influence behaviour. I think that's really important. Protecting people from rogue traders, you know, let's not forget that actually this is a really confusing space. It is out with the energy regulation. It falls into general consumer protections. That means it's very hard to understand whether you're using a reputable trader, what you should be expecting, what you do if something goes wrong, all of that, you know. And all that does is make people more uneasy and results in the occasional horror story that gets amplified and scares people from even having a go, because it's not cheap. And I think there's also, you know, that's linked to things like effective monitoring, trusted redress and all of that. But most importantly, I think it's this avoiding a boom and bust approach to these sorts of policies. We need investment from government and not policies that try and ramp up really quickly and then end abruptly. We need some actual sustainable investment into this so we can grow that pipeline of jobs and skills as well, because that's vital in this space. And the last thing I'd say is, you know, sustainability and fairness, really, really important. We're going to need different solutions for different people based on their income, based on their ability to engage and make decisions, based on their housing tenure.
Okay, I understand. It seems as if you're both agreeing that it's a kind of a portfolio approach that combines the role of the industry with the role of finance, with the availability of information. And I very much took your point about those, you know, rogue traders. But even leaving aside the, you know, potential for cowboys in the market, I tried to Google for solid wall insulation, and I couldn't find anything that made even any sense in my local area. So that just, you know, just one little anecdote.
Rob, don't you think that's a real policy failing? You know, the government should be having information there front and centre, especially at the moment, of how you get solid wall insulation. You know, a few years ago, people were asking publicly how to get a heat pump, and the best available information was a blog that I wrote. Now, this stuff shouldn't be random Google searches. There should be a portal that a consumer can go to that's got accredited advice that says, I want solid wall insulation, or even before that, your house needs solid wall insulation. This is a recommended measure. And that should be something that the energy performance certificate gives you. And then you should be able to click on a link that says, these are the local approved traders. And then you can get three quotes and you can get it done. I'm often staggered by the state of some of the things in the heat space. But, you know, even in Cornwall, if someone says to me, how do I get solid wall insulation? Where do I go? I honestly don't know. And that is just madness.
So who should be providing that information, though? I mean, Dara, why can't the industry do more? So why can't Energy UK make more information available to help confused heads of research institutes like myself?
It's a great question. What I'd say is solid wall insulation is not our speciality. Definitely know that there's a need for it. Partly, I think some of it comes down to we're not the go-to people when it comes to advice, right? People aren't going to turn to us and ring us up and tell us. It's hard enough. I think, you know, there's some findings with the recent Fuel Bank Foundation report, which talks about the Fuel Bank Foundation exists to support people who are struggling to top up their prepayment meter for electricity and gas. And one of the things they said, I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, it's around 90% of people who contacted them for support had not contacted their energy supplier first. People are reluctant to talk about what they're struggling with. So I'm not sure energy companies or an energy trade body is the right place to go for information. with my previous hat of Citizens Advice on. I mean, it's a trusted advice provider. I think that there's a huge gap on funded advice for energy efficiency, but also for, you know, low carbon heat and changing the way you heat your home. There is a tried and tested funding model for energy advice provision if you're struggling to pay your bills, and not just struggling to pay, but also complexity around any complaint you might have with your energy supplier. And I think that goes back to the original Gas Act. You know, that's a provision based on the fact that energy is an essential service. And I wonder if it's having a bit of a reset in thinking about actually reaching net zero is going to be an essential that we all have to do. And therefore, it's important that we consider independent, accessible, trustworthy advice that is, you know, self-serve for the people who can take the information and run with it because they've got the confidence that it's impartial. And then maybe a bit of extra support for people who are going to need help. There's also, I think, questions around tenure here. And I appreciate we don't have loads of time to go into it, but you know, there is something around how social housing could be leading the way when it comes to decarbonising heat based on the success of the Decent Homes Standard and doing things at scale.
Okay, we are running towards the end of our time, but let's focus in on some personal experience with all of this, because Richard, I know that your home down in Cornwall has been through a pretty extensive retrofit, and you have a heat pump. Is it warm in your home now in February? What's your experience of making going on this journey?
Well, I'm embarrassed to report that I tend to wear a t-shirt inside all year round, which is, if you're eco and sustainable conscious, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to have your house cold enough to wear a jumper all the time. So yeah, the heat pump's fine. It was a relatively challenging install. But that was because I shopped around. So what you're supposed to do is, well, shop around, of course, but not buy the heat pump yourself. And so I went straight to the supplier and bought my own kit. And that meant I saved a few thousand pounds in the process of doing that, but gave myself quite a lot of extra stress. So the house is always warm. I've only ever run out of hot water after a very big bath, because, of course, I do now have a hot water tank. But it fills up quite quickly again, so it's not really ever been an issue. Bills are quite good. I've been using a smart tariff, so I have a cheaper rate overnight generally, and I can heat up my hot water then, or I prioritise using the solar panels, which are on the roof, to charge up the hot water tank as well. And so overall, I'm getting a cost that's well below what it would be with gas. So I'm a really, really good case study of how to do it properly. This is not always the case. And this comes back to the point about why consumer protection is so important, because you can end up in a very, very good situation if you do this properly, if you combine the elements and if they're all sort of matched together. But if you get a rogue trader that fits the heat pump badly and it's not coordinated or sized correctly, you can end up in a situation where your bills go up quite significantly. And that doesn't need to happen ever, but it can. And so this really goes back to two things, I think. One is that there needs to be strong consumer protection here. The Government Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy is already talking about watering down some of the protections on heat pump installs. And I think everyone working on heat should be very aware that we need to keep some consumer protection there. And the other point is that this is just such a new market still. And so while heat pumps have existed for a really long time, there is no mature heat pump market in the UK. We have a very, very mature gas boiler market. And gas boilers are very easy to fit because you don't need to worry about things like sizing. You just put them on the wall and plumb them in and plumb the gas in, subject safety, and they will work. They're very forgiving as a technology. Heat pumps are less forgiving. And so there's a big point here about skills being focused on by the government. About growing the market sustainably without these boom and bust cycles.
Okay, thanks, Richard. And one of the things that UKIRC Research has been saying for several years now is that actually we could be learning from the widespread experiences of other countries where they've been through exactly the same problems with growing their experience in heat pumps or district heating. It's that the UK is an island, but we're not an island. And I think we do need to learn some of those lessons about the very important kind of installation quality issues that you've just mentioned. So we're out of time. Richard Lowes is a senior associate at the Regulatory Assistance Project. Dara Vyas is deputy director for policy at Energy UK. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKERC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.